We're thinking this morning about hope and the glory of God. And that got me thinking about I hope. What I hope for. And the kind of hopes that maybe we have. And I thought about these two. I hope I'll win the lottery. And I hope that my family will care for me. And I wonder, what's the difference between those two hopes? What's the difference between the things that maybe sometimes we hope for? We've got a series where we're looking at Romans, and we're working our way through, not in a kind of systematic way, a chapter by chapter, but looking at Romans through a few different lenses. So we're thinking about Romans, thinking about faith, hope, and love. And if you've been following it through carefully, you'll have picked up we've had an introduction, we've had two messages on faith, and this morning we're thinking about hope, and that'll carry on and continue in next week, and then we'll be thinking about love. We're looking at Romans through those lenses of faith, hope, and love. And as we look at hope, we need to actually go back to the start. We need to find our way back to the beginning of... Right over there? We need to find our way back to the beginning of Romans. Because actually, if you look through the first few verses of Romans, you find that there's a bit of an introduction that kind of starts us off. And as Paul begins this letter, he starts off bringing a lot of the themes that he's going to be talking about later into the letter. And right at the start of the letter, we have this mention of a promise. If you get nothing out of this morning, please get this out of it, that our hope is thoroughly linked to the promises of God. And right at the start, Romans chapter 1 verse 2, he introduces this idea of the promise of God. That God promised beforehand, the gospel he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures. And if you get into the Greek of this and you look at the Greek that's underneath it, you'll find that actually there's one word that we've got translated as two there. Promised beforehand is in fact one long and complicated word in the Greek. Greek you can have fun with, and you can kind of make new words by mashing other words together. And that's the sort of thing that Paul did there, just to make it really hard for people translating it later on, just merging things together. But that word for promised beforehand, it's one word that God announced ahead of time. That God announced ahead his promises to us. Paul sees that as something important enough. He's introducing it right at the start of his letter. And sometimes we're generally a people who are quite adverse to announcing things ahead. We generally don't like to get ahead of ourselves. There's an English saying, I assume it's an English saying, don't count your chickens before they've hatched. Okay, so don't count what you've got before you've actually got it. Don't announce, don't declare, don't boast what you already have before you've really got it. Other cultures have much better kind of proverbs and sayings than we do in Britain. So I'm sure there's others who could do a much better job at bringing in some sayings about not announcing things ahead, about not getting ahead of yourself in declaring or saying what you already have. But there's one time of year where I think announcing ahead becomes particularly good fun. Is anybody like me, and when it comes to the time of a general election, enjoys staying up and watching the election results come in? Anybody? There we go, thank you. Okay, there's a few people. I had this idea, people have Eurovision Song Contest parties, and they stay up late and watch all of Eurovision. I don't know why. But I was wondering whether the next general election I might have a general election party and a bunch of us people, the 3.5 people who just put their hand up, can gather with me. We'll watch the results roll in through the night of the general election with lots of exciting BBC graphics and things like that. Some of you are keen. Anyway, but it's one of the times when announcing ahead becomes quite fun. Because if you know, the law in the UK works that while people are voting in the election, the media aren't allowed to say anything about how the voting is going. Because if you said something, it might affect the vote. If you say one particular side is winning, then a load of people might come out and vote for the other side. And a load of people might stay at home who would have come out and voted for the other side. So they're not allowed to say anything until voting stops at, I think it's 10 o'clock in the evening when the polls have to close. But then when they get to that point, there's this suddenly kind of amazingly exciting moment on the BBC where suddenly they're allowed to reveal the poll that they've been taking all day of how people have been voting. And it's their little bit where they announce ahead what they believe the result of that election is going to be, that we probably won't really see until the small hours or early the following morning when the votes have been counted. Nothing has been counted yet, but there's this moment where they announce it. And at the last general election, that was really good fun. I'm sorry, I'm really sad. But for people like me, that was really good fun because there was this moment when it was announced and you kind of saw them all going, that can't be right. If you followed it, if you're like me, you saw there was this moment where they all kind of went, nah, that's not right. And one particular famous moment is a guy called Paddy Ashdown, a Liberal Democrat, said, if this poll is right, I will eat my hat. Because the poll showed that the Liberal Democrats, his party, were going to lose loads and loads of seats. The poll said they were going to have 10 MPs, and it turned out the poll was right. They actually had less than that. They only had 8 in the end. But he was so shocked at this announcing ahead of this result. He couldn't believe it was going to be true. Another little English phrase, I'll eat my hat if that's true. He was so surprised. There's a sense of announcing ahead of what is coming. And that's what Romans chapter 1 verse 2 is saying, that God has announced ahead what is going to happen. God has promised ahead what is going to happen. And God has always been in the business of making promises. We see the way that God has actually promised all the way through the Bible. One of the ways that we see that, we go right the way back to Genesis. And even in that narrative of Genesis, we see a sense of God's promise. Genesis chapter 3, when God is announcing curses upon Adam and Eve and upon the serpent for what's happened in the Garden of Eden, he says to the serpent that man, he will crush your head. And we see something in there of God's promise that one day a descendant of Adam will defeat evil. And we see the promises of God to Noah in the rainbow after the flood. We've been thinking the last few weeks a lot about the promises to Abraham made in Genesis chapter 15 and 17, the covenant that God made with Abraham. And then as we go through, we see some other slightly different promises that God has made and that people have seen. If you want to turn to Psalm 16, it's page 549 if you're using the church Bibles. You can find something of a promise that God made long ago to David, recorded in this psalm. Psalm 16, and I'll begin from verse 7. I will praise the Lord who counsels me. Even at night my heart instructs me. I keep my eyes always on the Lord. With him at my right hand I shall not be shaken. Therefore my heart is glad and my tongue rejoices. My body also will rest secure, because he will not abandon me to the realm of the dead, nor will you let your faithful one see decay. You have made known to me the path of life, and you fill me with joy in your presence, with eternal pleasures at your right hand. David here sees a sense that life goes beyond the grave. The promises of God. And later on in Acts chapter 2, around verse 22, we see Peter picking up on just these words of David in his first sermon, explaining what it is that what's happened with Jesus Christ, explaining how it's been promised ahead, how God said he would raise his chosen one, his son, from the dead. Picking up on the promises God made long ago. But we're going to spend a bit of time thinking about Abraham this morning. Romans writes a lot about Abraham, and it mixes in a lot here with what we're thinking about hope and the promises that God made to Abraham. Just to help us in picking up from last week, as we began this reading in verse 13, last week we were thinking a lot about the law and faith. And we see helpfully here, reinforcing for us in verse 13, that it was not through the law that Abraham and his offspring received the promise. That it's not through the law that Abraham received the promise that God made to him. But it was by faith. Verse 16, therefore the promise comes by faith, so that it may be by grace and may be guaranteed to all Abraham's offspring. Now, when we think about the promise that was made to Abraham, if we think about Genesis chapter 15, chapter 17, I think the things that we often think about, that I often think about, represented by those couple of pictures. We think about land, we think about Israel, the promised land, that we think, well, Abraham was promised this land flowing with milk and honey. That was the promise that God made to him, wasn't it? And we think about that other promise. It's so easy for us to imagine and to picture, because he said, you'll have descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. And I don't know about you, but that's often what I think of when I'm thinking about the promises that God made to Abraham. And then I think, well, yes, and of course God worked out those promises, didn't he? Because we see the Israelites, they're freed from Egypt, and we see some of the numbers that are recorded in that story, and how they've grown to be this people so numerous, and then God leads them through the wilderness, and he leads them into the promised land, and we see the land of Israel. And we see, oh, well, how God has fulfilled his promises. But Romans actually helps us here by picking out not those kind of specifics that we often think about, but actually seeing how God's promise was so much bigger to Abraham than sometimes we ever think about. Verse 13, it says that it was not through the law that Abraham received the promise. And this was the promise that Paul writes about. Received the promise that he would be heir of the world. His promise wasn't just about one particular piece of land, but his promise to Abraham was that he would be heir of the world. And in verse 17, when we think about Abraham's offspring, verse 17 says, quotes from Genesis, it says, as it is written, I have made you a father of many nations. He is our father in the sight of God in whom he believed. It doesn't just talk about Abraham being the father of one particular people, the father of one group of Israelites, but Abraham being the father of many nations. The father of all different people brought together in God's family. It's why we sing the song. You know the one. Father Abraham had many sons. Many sons had Father Abraham. I am one of them, and so are you. So let's all praise the Lord. Right, we won't go on. But just for some, that will be stuck in their head now for the whole day, which is going to be good. And we sing that, we teach it to children, we never really explain what it means. Anyway, but it's why we have the song, isn't it? Because we've all been adopted into this family of God, that actually begins with Abraham and this promise to him, not just of his people, but of many nations. And so the promises that are made to Abraham, the promise, this covenant that's made to him, isn't just a promise for him and his descendants, but is for us all, if we place our faith in God. This promise that God would establish his rule and his people, not just over one particular part of the world, but over the whole earth. That God will establish his rule, that God will restore and reign as king over the whole world. And so it's not a promise that we see just fulfilled in the Old Testament as we read about Israel taking over a particular land, but a promise that we see still coming for us in the future, that God has promised beforehand that he will rule and restore the whole earth. That one day we will see God's splendor fully displayed. That Jesus says in Mark 13 that one day he's going to come and return in power and glory. We have this hope of the glory of God. As we heard read to us earlier, we boast in the hope of the glory of God. That Jesus will return in power and glory, and that when we see him, we'll be changed to be like he is. That we'll be changed to reflect the glory of God. And even from Romans itself, as we've been thinking about the law and about sin over the last few weeks, we've been forced to recognise for ourselves once again that, of course, we all fall short. We all sin and fall short of what? The glory of God. That one day there'll be no more sin, no more falling short of the glory of God. Romans 5 verse 2 makes it clear that we have this hope in the glory of God. But the emphasis here, as we go through this passage, as we look through this little section of Romans 4 and 5, the emphasis isn't about how strong our hope is. The emphasis isn't about this hope that we have, that is this kind of strength, this deep inner strength that we have about how good we are, about how strong we hope for the future, but actually about God's promise. And as we look at the story of Abraham, we see something, perhaps, of what this is about. This hope in the glory of God. Because it describes in verse 18 of chapter 4 that Abraham, against all hope, Abraham in hope believed. Against all hope. There's this real sense here of clinging on. That Abraham clinged on to what he could. Not as Abraham being this person who had this amazingly strong sense of hope in what God would do, but Abraham at times of one who clinged on against all hope. He believed. Clinging on despite how impossible things may have seemed to him. And perhaps that sense of clinging on seems sometimes very true for us as well. Abraham had been promised a child by God. Abraham and Sarah had no children, and God promised that they would have a child. And as we read through in Romans, it's very clear that Abraham believed the promise that he was given. The question here isn't whether Abraham believed or not the promise that God had given. It's very clear that Abraham believed God. But Abraham was given that promise. Abraham and Sarah were given that promise of children, and they had to wait a long time. As you read through the narrative in Genesis, you see they waited a long time. And it seems as though somewhere in there they began to wonder what it was that God was doing. You've made us this promise. Why are we waiting? And in Genesis chapter 16, we read about Sarah going to Abraham and saying, God has stopped me from having children. God will still not allow me to have children. So go and take my slave, take Hagar, and have a child with her. Maybe we can have descendants through her instead. And I wonder how much they thought, maybe this is what we're meant to do. Maybe when God said we'd have descendants, this is what he wanted us to do. Maybe God just expected us to kind of work it out. Maybe we need to help God along a little bit. As we read through that, we see the sense of it wasn't how strong Abraham and Sarah's hope was in what God was going to do. It wasn't about how amazing their hope was. But just like us, they had to face this situation where it felt like they were hoping against hope. That they believed, but they really wondered what it was that God was doing. So why didn't they just give up? Why not just give up? Well, Abraham had the promise of God. Abraham had the promise that God had made him. Against all hope, Abraham in hope believed. Just as it had been said to him, so shall your offspring be. Hoping against hope, he had something to cling on to. He had this promise of God. But why was that promise anything to believe in? He didn't just have a promise, but he had something to base it upon. He had the God who had made that promise to him. It says in verse 20, yet he did not waver through unbelief regarding the promise of God, but was strengthened in his faith and gave glory to God, being fully persuaded that God had the power to do what he had promised. He recognised who God is. That God was the one who had power to do what he had promised. And enter into it for a moment, into the reality of Abraham's situation. Describes here, in quite bold words I would say, I wouldn't look to describe anyone who's older in these terms, but this is the terms that Paul uses. He faced the fact that his body was as good as dead since he was about 100 years old. and at Sarah's womb was also dead. He faces this deep sense of death, of nothingness, that this real sense that there was no hope, that there was nothing that could be done. We know so often there's so many things that we can do something about, don't we? So many things in life that we face that happen to us that we can try and work our way through, that we can respond to in some way, that we can come up with a plan, that we can try and do something, that someone could help us with. But we know that death is one of those things that we can't do anything about. We know that we can't cheat death. And we know that as we face it, it has that deep sense of nothingness. That deep sense of emptiness that so often we don't want to come up against. I happened to be in a hospice yesterday, and one of the things I noticed they had written up on the wall was saying that they wanted, I think it must have been their mission statement as to what they wanted to be, and it said on there that we wanted to be a place where people could openly talk about death. Why did they need to have that in their mission statement? Because they recognise we're not a society that talks about death, that we're not willing to openly talk about it. Because it's hard. Because it's one of those things that we feel like we can do nothing about. Because it carries that deep sense of nothingness. Abraham and Sarah found them in that place of feeling there was nothing that they could do. This nothingness, this emptiness. And I know there's people here who are members of this church who are much closer to facing that than I would like them to be. And it's okay to cry about it. It's okay to be sad about it. It's okay to recognise at times our hope isn't what we'd like it to be. That we don't have the strength in us that at times maybe we wish we did. Maybe for some here it's not even facing death, it's facing that sense of nothingness, of emptiness. That you face a situation and you just recognise a powerlessness to do anything about it. Maybe it's a childlessness that's far too close to Abraham and Sarah. Maybe it's just that recognition that sometimes it's empty, that we feel empty, and we just don't know what to do about it. Abraham recognised that God had the power. That God is the one who has the power. We can see it so much more clearly than Abraham even had the opportunity to. We're the ones who are able to look back to the very beginning. We can read Genesis and we can see that our God is someone who didn't need anything to create. That God was the one who was able to create out of nothing. That nothingness isn't a problem to God. That God is the one who's able to take nothing and create all that we see around us. God is the one who's able to take emptiness and bring life, to turn dust and breathe life into it. That we see in what David wrote, even David had this picture that death was not the end, that God was the one who was able to overcome death. We see it in Jesus Christ, that death was not the end, but God is the one who's able to win the victory over the grave. We see it as we read through to the end, that we read Revelation, that there is this hope for us that goes beyond the grave. That we have the hope of the resurrection of the dead. That we have the hope of the return of Jesus Christ. That he will come in glory and we will be
with him. We have a God who can create out of nothing and can bring life even out of death. We have a God who is powerful. Abraham didn't just see a God who was powerful, though, a God who was almighty. He saw a God who was faithful. Hebrews 11:11 says this, "And by faith, even Sarah, who was past childbearing age, was enabled to bear children, because she considered him faithful who had made the promise." Abraham had been given this promise, but it wasn't an empty promise. It was a promise by a God who'd announced it would happen already. A God who was the God who had the power to be able to fulfill his promises, and a God who was faithful that could be trusted to keep his promises. He had a promise that was based upon something. What's the difference between hoping that I'll win the lottery and hoping that my family will care for me? Hoping that I'll win the lottery is based on a staggeringly poor amount of odds, a staggeringly poor sense of chance of actually that happening. Hope that my family will care for me is surrounded by what I know of my family, of people who I've known care and love me and look after me and be there for me. We have a hope that's based upon something, on a God who is powerful and a God who is faithful. And so Romans goes on to say that actually that's something we can boast in. How rarely we're told that we're able to boast in something. How kind of uncomfortable we feel about the fact that we've been told here is something that we're allowed to boast in. That we can boast in the glory of God, through whom we've gained access by faith into this grace in which we now stand. And we boast in the hope of the glory of God. Perhaps we feel a bit more comfortable with it when the verse goes on in the next verse. It says, "Not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings." And we feel a bit more comfortable with that, rather than just feeling we can boast in something good. When it talks there about glorying in sufferings, note that it's not because of sufferings. It's not that we go out looking for things to be difficult, but recognising that even in suffering, we can have hope. That those things can work in our lives. We glory in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance, character, and character, hope. And hope does not put us to shame. I got all of those links, but I struggled a little bit to think about how it is that character led to hope. I spent a while pondering how it is that character leads to hope. Because we recognise that we have a God who is powerful. How does that character lead on to hope? And I think as we recognise that God who's powerful, that's faithful, that keeps his promises, as we go through sufferings and we learn to persevere, actually we see how God has been at work. That actually as we're able to look back and see what God has done, how God has been faithful to our promises, that becomes part of our character. That actually we become more hopeful people. That actually we can grow in hope, not through some inner strength and resilience that we have in ourselves, but actually as we come to know and experience more of the promises and the faithfulness of God. I think that's what we see in Abraham. I think that's what we see in the change in Abraham from being someone who didn't seem to know how God was going to fulfill his promise and went along with this plan to have a child with someone else, to the Abraham who was willing to get to the point of nearly sacrificing his only son, believing, as we're told, that he thought even God could raise the dead. He grew in his hope as he grew in the knowledge and the promises of God. We glory in the hope that we have, and it says here that we will not be put to shame. That we can glory in that hope and we will not be put to shame. Because, of course, the hope that we have is something that's laughable to so many. I'm sure it must have been completely laughable to the people around Abraham, the idea that he and Sarah would somehow have children at the age that they were. How stupid, how laughable. Just like reminds me of Noah building the ark and the people who came to mock him and say, "What on earth are you doing?" It's laughable, it's silly. us today when these verses talk about suffering, the type of suffering it's referring to is actually the suffering of the oppression that we receive in a hostile and difficult world. That we'll look foolish in the world's eyes for the kind of hope that we have in God's promises. That we'll look foolish. That will look outdated. That even what we're doing together this morning will look like so many a waste of time. That in the face of what happens in the world, how can you believe in a God who keeps his promises? But we're told here that we will not be disappointed. We won't be put to shame. We won't be disappointed, but we will be sustained because God's love has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. That will be sustained by God through the power of the Holy Spirit at work in us. We have this hope of the glory of God, all because of the promises that God has given to us. We're going to carry on as we think about hope next week and continuing. But I want to leave you with some things to ponder between now and next week. How will you grow and sustain your hope? How will you come to know more of the promises of God? What have you done as a result of the hope that you have? How does your hope in God make a difference in the way you've lived your life? And what difference will your hope make over the coming weeks, months, year? How will the hope you have change the way that you live tomorrow?